Before we start, I wanted to do the various procedural things. So there's a certain number. So the complication is some of you are coming from McMaster, some of you are here, and maybe people from elsewhere. And moving forward, where we actually physically hold the class depends on the preferences of the students, but in particular, the ones who are enrolled. And so I know some people will be enrolled, some people will be auditing, and the more the merrier. But for the location, you know, offline versus online, it's the enrolled people that count. So of you guys, how many of you are enrolled as opposed to tourists? So basically all but say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right. And also just to get me a sense as to your locations, what fraction of you, who are you, who came from Mac today? So it's the same people, I think, right? Yeah. All right. So the people, the PI people, you know, you don't have to decide today, but next week or something, I'll ask these guys again, you know, where they want to have it, and they may not want to come here. And if that's true, you may not care. You know, at that point, you'll see what it's like a little bit. And to have a voice in that choice, enroll. And it's not like it's. And the purpose of that, from my side, is that from experience, I know that it's easy to audit a course and then 3 weeks in. Decide no, that's not worth it, and then just bail. But we kind of make the commitments now. And if everybody from McMaster is coming and everybody here is bailed, then that's kind of silly. So the auditing is really just, the enrollment is just really to establish a commitment. And you shouldn't fear marks. So you know there will be assignments, a few assignments. It's not going to be. I don't see a course like this as being one of your core courses where it really matters if you know you get an A or an A minus or whatever. But it's true that in a course like this, it's worth doing the exercises because hearing someone talk about quantum field theory, you know, it never sinks in. You have to really do it. And so I'm going to have some exercises, and there'll be a quiz at the end, but I'm not looking at this thing as being, that'll be a big barrier to participation. So given that, think about whether you want to enroll, and then I'll ask this question again next week, and we will, you know, we can converge on where we actually physically do this. And that goes for you people at home, too. I don't know how to quiz you guys. Some of you, I know who you are, and so I know whether you're enrolled or not. But for next week, if you're not enrolled online, think about it. Would you be enrolled if it was not on Zoom, which I can understand is a bit of a hellscape? And anyway, make your choices, and then we can move on from there. Second procedural thing is there's a website. So I'll ask it as a question. So who here has had an introductory course in quantum field theory? I'm thinking pretty much everybody, right? Yeah. Because this course is aimed at people who are not seeing it for the first time. And who took the quantum field theory in PSI? Anybody? It is you. Okay. So I asked that because I have an idea of what you've seen. Whereas the rest of you, you know, I don't really know what you've seen. And so I'm taking the so the goal of this course, as I understand it, the niche that's needed to be filled is kind of topics in quantum field theory that are not the introductory ones, and the vehicle. So I'm going to try and hit those things, and the vehicle for that will be QED. I'm just going to take QED as the example. Because it's a good example, you know. And the reason you don't start with QED normally is that it's a little bit of a complicated example. But the point of this course is the complications. And I know that you've seen typically non-abelian gauge theories, so that there's nothing. It's not like you're not getting non-abelian gauge theories by not seeing it here. And the things that I will do here in QED usually have an analog in non-abelian gauge theories, and I can kind of say. Or, you know, particularly if you have a question about it, you can ask about it. You know, how things change. Did I turn my microphone on? Yeah, I did. And so the topic list is, a wish list is on the web page, and I'll give you the link for the web page for the course. So this is like QFT2. And I'm just putting the information as, and when there's assignments, I'll put the assignments there, and It's just it's a page that I'm maintaining rather than a official page. And so it's at physics master. And then it's kind of a bizarre, because it's one I'm maintaining rather than an official one. I don't know why it's got to be there twice, but it's historical reasons probably. And the particular page, if you go to this, this will take you to my webpage, and then you can follow the link to courses, and then the last one on the list is this one. But it's the page itself. This will take you right to the page. So all the information will be there, and in particular, there's a curriculum there now. And I'll just say what it is. And that's a curriculum for this course when I taught it, where we used the whole term. And we only have half the term now. So it's an ambitious curriculum that we're not going to get through everything for. So the reason I'm telling you that is which topics we do can be influenced by what you want to see a little bit. So, let me get to the page. So the topics are, so the first one is which fields for which particles. Second topic was just QED, kind of the definition of what it is. And part of this will be, operators versus path integral. Then there'll be loops. And the focus here will be divergences. How do you regulate them? And that'll be IR and UV, and how you deal with each. And there are things that are, you deal with them differently. Often, the convenient regularization, if you have a gauge theory, which we will be dimensional regularization. And often integrals are zero in dimensional regularization. And there's a subtlety there where the zero is happening because there's a UV divergence canceling an IR divergence. And what you do with the divergences is different. So you'd like to actually, that zero, you'd like to pick it apart into the piece that's UV, because that you're going to normalize. And what's left will be the IR divergence, which you want to keep track of, because that's normally telling you you've done something wrong. And so you want to see that cancel on physical things. So those tools are very useful. And then once we start talking about this, then the next topic will be IR divergences. And that would be the, how you make these things cancel. So that could be, the classic one is Bloch Nordzig. But there's then the Kaelin theorem is the one that applies to non-abelian gauge series. And then the wish list, I think we're going to be lucky if we get here. But the next two would be non-perturbative things. And here I mean old-fashioned non-perturbative things like the Lehmann-Schellen theorem. And things like that. And then six would have been anomalies. And we could add things, we take things away, depending on if there's a whole bunch of people here have a specific topic you want to see, then we can do that. But I'm going to start. So the goal of this is supposed to be this is the thing which of all these things, these two are the ones that you're likely to have seen if you've seen things before. But I want to approach this from the Weinbergian way, where I'm going to focus mostly on spin zero, spin a half, and spin one. And then there's basically the statement here is, you're expressing fields, local fields, in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And there's a bunch of wave functions involved. And basically, on flat space, those wave functions are Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. And so they're completely determined up to normalization by symmetry. And the story is that the fields are transforming under Lorentz transformations in finite dimensional non-unitary representations. The creation operators are transforming in unitary infinite dimensional representations, so they're different. And then the wave function is the Clebsch-Gordan that takes you from one to the other. And the information You take some random field and some random particle, and you won't find any Clebsch-Gordan coefficient that'll do it for you. And so the rules for which fields you can use to represent which particles and why it's all unique and it doesn't really matter, there's no physics in it really, it's just a choice of how you do things, comes from that. So I'd like to sketch that out. And I think that's something which is, that's not normally the way it's presented in an introductory course. So I'm hoping that'll be new. And then that sets up also, it makes it very easy to prove things like the spin statistics theorem and the CBT theorem and the existence of antiparticles, crossing symmetry. Those all kind of just fall out because when you can do that for the particles, and then you ask to be Lorentz invariant, and so you ask time orderings in particular to be Lorentz invariant, so that Hamiltonians have to commute with one another at space-like separations, and it kind of gives you all those things. And the fact that you were dictated in what your wave functions were by symmetry shows you that there's no way to avoid the conclusions by changing them. So that's kind of where those are going to go. This will be kind of much more mainstream once we know the fields. You know, so I'll set this up, and so the Dirac equation is just basically this Clebsch-Gordan story. Part of the story is if you do it for spin one massless particle, which we're going to want to do for QED, you're tempted to think that the field that you'll be allowed to use is a vector for the electromagnetic potential, and that's false, turns out. Electromagnetic potentials can only, if you have a field in the AB representation, and I'll explain this, but if you know what it is already, you'll know what it is. The helicities that these can represent is basically B minus A. And a four vector is a half a half, and so the only helicity zero can be represented by a vector. And so what this argument leads you to is that the minimal field for describing a spin massless spin one particle is in the 0, 1 plus 1, 0 representation, which is an anti-symmetric tensor. And if you kind of figure out the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, it's the curl of something. And so then you say, well, so I lied to you. The thing it was the curl of is the vector we're looking for. And the point is that it's not a vector. It's only a four vector up to gauge transformations. And so that's why you're forced to do gauge transformations if you want to use the vector to represent the photons. So there's an interesting backstory to this, even though it's introductory material is the main thing. So this will be kind of conceptual. This will be more pragmatic. And that's the plan. And you can see that list on the web page. For the first part, I have notes for much of this. From here on in, it's handwritten, but I've made a scan of them, so I'll make those available on the webpage. For this part of it, there's another course I teach in January at Mac, which is an introduction to quantum field theory for undergraduates. And because it's for undergraduates, it starts with non-relativistic quantum field theory, because they know non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And the point of that is that quantum field theory is really all it is the quantum mechanics that this allows you to describe processes where you change the number of particles, but there's nothing that forces you to be relativistic when you do that. But once you do this story, you'll see that if you're going to do quantum mechanics and relativity, then you're forced to change the number of particles, so you need quantum field theory. But the baggage of the relativistic side of things is kind of extra for the undergraduates. So about halfway through these notes in chapter 10, these things I'm going to be telling you about now, they're done in detail there in those notes. So if you want to kind of see the backstory, it's there. And in particular, I'm going to just do basically spin zero, spin one half, and spin one. And the general case of general spins and general representations is done in those notes. And so, and they're just, the notes are just channeling Weinberg's volume one book. So it's, but Weinberg's volume one book, it's a, you know, like the Torah, you're going to learn something every time you read it, but it may not be the most clearly explained thing that you've ever seen in your life. And so, so the hope is that these notes help you with that. So the link to the notes is, if you go to this web page, up here, there's a tab which is courses, which will take you to this one. But there's a tab which is lecture notes, and there's a list of my lecture notes. And four things down is the quantum field theory, quantum field theory, the notes, which is for this course. Okay. Any questions about that? That's kind of where the plan is to go. I think that's all I wanted to say procedurally, yeah.
Will you cover what I need to
teach? I could cover them if you want to, yeah. So we could stick it in there. Okay, I'll make a note of that, because that's something that's easy to do along the way. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know, like, for other people, but is it like, so if we've seen, like, a renormalization in the past, is this like an introduction to renormalization, or do we cover, because I've never seen like infrared divergences, but I've seen the like UV divergences with dimensional regulation and that.
Right. So I'm gonna try and be self-contained so that you don't need to, so the notation will be clear. So every time I start a topic, I think it's gonna look like stuff you've seen, but I'm gonna not try and be slow when I do it. So what I'm hoping will happen is that everyone will recognize the first part of every topic, and then we'll share the notation, and then we'll get into stuff that is new. So, but that's partly where feedback comes in. So, you know, if I judge that wrong and I'm spending too long on something, tell me, and if it's too fast, tell me. Because it's easy to adjust that, but that's the intention for all these topics. So, you know, I'm expecting that most people will have seen QED at some level. You'll have seen loops. The thing we often find, if you're taking courses in a very short time frame, there's a lot of material that you're learning at once, and the renormalization story can be more subtle than it looks at the first time you see it. And so that's part of the, and in particular, when you have both infrared and UV divergences going on at the same time, this sets up the renormalization group also nicely, which people may or may not have done. And so, okay, that's those are the topics. And I also wanted to put my timer on so I don't run over. And the plan also, so we're doing it on one day. The goal, the idea was that if everyone's coming here for the day who's not here, it's 3 hours a week, and having all three in the same day, split by lunch, and the seminars are in between, was the plan. And again, that can be, depending on where we decide to do this, if we're not doing it here and people are not making the trip, then we can split things up on different days if that's necessary. But given that schedules are being made, changing the day is probably something to avoid if we can. But all right, let me get my timer on. It's now 10:26. And each of these, so the morning and the afternoon are meant to be an hour and a half. So the book is the room is booked for 2 hours, but so we have the room when the lecture ends, and so feel free to stay and talk. But I'm going to aim to be done. I'll start at 10, end at 11:30, start at 2:30, end at 4. So let's give myself 0 hours. Okay. All right. Good. So, if we're good, and I don't know if any questions in online about any of that procedural stuff. And you guys at online, you should feel free to interject yourself. Thank you, Adam, for the thumbs up. So to interject yourself, if you see that there's something you want to ask, the online thing, we're trying to make it so that you can, it's not passive. And so if you have questions, the questions really help a lot when you're doing a lecture like this, because not everybody's going to have the same background, and it really helps to identify how much detail to show. And so you people at home, I'm not going to see your chat, so don't just politely put something in the chat and wait to be acknowledged. Say something, you know, just say something to get our attention, and then feel free to jump in, because it's I'm thinking of you guys as being part of the class. All right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to start off with the first topics. And I'm going to be, for this first part, I'm going to be following these notes that are on this webpage reasonably closely. I should actually ask, so in the introductory courses you've seen, you know, the very first thing you do normally for relativistic quantum field theory is you set it up normally with quantum mechanics, with symmetries. The symmetries are represented by unitary or anti-unitary operators. You know, the ones that are continuously related to the identity, you can exponentiate, and so that defines a Hermitian operator. Those are things that could be observables. And I'm kind of taking for granted in the non-relativistic case you've seen that. And then the story for relativity is you want to do that for the Poincaré group. And so I'd like to set up, you know, define the Poincaré group and take you through the first steps of that, which I think I'm fairly sure you've seen. So the first thing I want to ask is, have you seen it? So who's happy with, if you had to right now, blindfolded, write down the Poincaré algebra, could you do it? Sounds like some could, some couldn't, but it's a that's not a big deal. So I want you know the point of this will be that there's no this is something which you don't have to be smart, you just have to be a good accountant. And so these are all it's just all algebra, and it's the point of knowing that is that when if you're thinking in your your real job, what can I change to try and solve some problem? You want to know what's just dictated by symmetries and what's not. And so emphasizing what's just algebra underlines, what's just a consequence of fundamental things and can't be fooled with. So the goal, and that's useful because the second thing will be, I'm going to need to know these two kinds of representations that are arising, because there's the interplay between how particles are represented and how fields are represented is key for a lot of these properties of fields. So there, let me ask again, who's happy if you had to write down what the representation of the Poincaré group is on particle states? Who's happy with that? Or is that, sounds like some are, but there's fewer hands. And how about these finite dimensional representations, the AB story of Lorentz group? How many are happy with that? Oh, fewer hands are showing. I don't know if that's just because people are just don't want to show their hands. Because it's true that in a group setting, that's going to be so. Don't hesitate to say. I'm deliberately asking the things that you know as opposed to what you don't know. So, yeah.
I think that in what we've seen, we followed the approach of the Peskin and Schroeder book. So we've seen
you use the wrong metric is what you're telling me.
But anyways, my point is that we learned that stuff, but not from the representation theory.
Yeah,
it's good to see that.
Yeah, part. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'll leave this up here, just in case.
All this stuff you're talking about in your chapter 10 of your notes.
Yeah. This stuff, the chapter 10 in those old notes.
All the group stuff you're talking about now.
That's also there, yeah.
Yeah, okay, as long as it's
Yeah. So it's in many places. I think many quantum field theory books, the ones that are aimed at relativity, they'll all have this somewhere. It's Weinberg has it. I forget where. It'll be volume one somewhere. But all right. So let's start. So the message is, why do quantum field theory? So, I took Weinberg's course on quantum field theory, really great course, but he doesn't get to, canonical quantization until January. The fall is, why are you doing quantum field theory, basically? And that's where a lot of these things are coming from, because he's one of the guys who was basically setting this stuff up back in the day. And the logic of it is that the pitch he's making is that there is essentially nothing in quantum field theory apart from quantum mechanics and a few motherhood properties that you would like to bake into any theory you talk about. And those motherhood properties are things like, unitarity. You'd like to have, for special relativity, you'd like to have a Poincaré invariance. Another one is cluster decomposition, which we can include or not in these topics depending on how you think about it. But cluster decomposition is just basically the statement that, if you probabilities of independent events factorize, so if I flip heads, flip a coin many times, the probability of each flip is the product of many flips is the product of each one separately. And then, in physics, we're thinking that things that are space-like separated at a given time, they can't influence each other. Those should be independent unless you prepare some correlation in the past. And so the statement is that, and this is really, in the end of the day, I think it's a statement of experimental fact. But it's what seems to be true is that if you take probabilities for space-like separated events, they factorize in the absence of if you let something sit for a while and don't kind of set it up in a very precise way where you've built in correlations and through some EPR experiment or something, probabilities really do factorize, and that says two things. It says that the state you've got has the property that probabilities are factorizing if they're space-like separated. But the evolution of them in time is also factorizing in position as you go through in time. And because the evolution in time, so those two things tell you two things. And the two things they tell you are that correlation functions you know, say like xt 5 yt, if you take the connected part of a correlation function and you separate x and y, these things all fall off. You know, they all fall off to zero, either like a power law or exponentially depending on your system, but they fall off to zero. So it goes to zero as x minus y goes to infinity. And the second thing it says, that since time evolution is, you know, e to the minus I ht, that's what u is. If you want different positions to evolve forward in an uncorrelated way, so probabilities remain factorized, you want this evolution to be a product over positions of something. So in some qualitative way, you'd like to say this is a product over x of e to the minus I h at some point x times time, which is to say that you're saying that h is coming to you as a sum over x of h sub x. And so there's a locality that's being built in by this requirement of cluster decomposition. So cluster decomposition is kind of a basic, one of the basic things you ask. And it's behind things like spontaneous symmetry breaking and a lot of things that we take for granted and that happen in field theory but don't happen in quantum mechanics. And so so the pitch that Weinberg is making in his life basically is that provided that you want to build in motherhood properties like this, unitarity, Lorentz invariance, there's no content in quantum field theory. It's just basically quantum mechanics with those properties. And all quantum field theory is, it's a very efficient way of building in these properties, and that's it. And in particular, the local part is associated with building in this property. So, and so the idea is you're not supposing that I want to learn quantum field theory. What you really want to do is quantum mechanics with relativity, and then you're forced to do quantum field theory, is what he'd like to argue, if you want to have these properties. And of course, these properties don't rely on relativity. You want them also in condensed matter physics, and that's kind of why they also use quantum field theory very often, even if they're not changing the number of particles. That was a bit of a rabbit hole. All right, so let me get started in the real topics here. So what we want to do is, quantum mechanics plus special relativity. And in quantum mechanics, when you have a symmetry, what you're normally saying is that if I have states that are related by symmetry, I'll say that, you know, that there's some unitary or anti-unitary transformation that relates them if they're related by the symmetry. And so you'll have a bunch of transformations. And for each transformation, you'll have a different unitary representation of that transformation in the Hilbert space of states. And what we'd like to do is to do that for the symmetry group of relativity, which is the one where you ask that if you have a space-time position, it's going to some matrix lambda mu nu x nu plus a mu. So this is the Poincaré group. And this part of it is the Lorentz part. And what we want is we want the invariant distance. So if we distance in space-time is minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared for flat space. So that's eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. And, you know, this is the metric we're going to use. And, you know, at some level, this is where it's like learning the facts of life when you're teaching the facts of life when you're a parent. This is where I tell you about the facts of metric conventions. You know, choose whichever one you like. That's up to you. But you know, if you choose the wrong one, you'll be sorry. and so why is this a good choice? You know, I think independent of which is the preference, what you should do is once you've done it, all the various identities you're going to use in life, like the gamma matrix identities, work them through once and for all in your conventions, and then write it down somewhere so you don't have to rederive it all the time. And then never take anything from a book, because you'll spend more time trying to figure out what the, you know, how to get rid of the errors between what their conventions were and yours. And if you just take the logic of what they're trying to do and just redo it in your own conventions. And so the important thing there is to have a set of conventions that you trust. And so what I can give you is in these conventions, I can give you ones that have got 40 years worth of testing. And I got them with, you know, from Weinberg with 40 years more of testing. And so And another thing, you should never trust books because books are riddled with typos, with a few exceptions. And so you want to really have a sacred set of things where you've written down your conventions, where all the signs are right, and you never have to question them again. And so part of this story here will be, I'll give you those conventions for the various identities we're going to use, but with this metric. And if you use any other metric, you're on your own. But the advantage of this metric, mostly, is if you're ever doing finite temperature field theory, or if you're ever going to Euclidean space, where you change the sign of this guy, then all your vectors, all your p squareds are going to be positive in that case. Whereas if you do plus, minus, 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 all your vectors squareds are negative, and it's a bitch trying to find signs where your mind will see a square and it'll think it's positive, even though you'll know it's negative. And that's your notation fighting you. And so you want your notation should be your friend. It should be helping you recognize what the signs are. And this is a much the better, I think, convention for that, because whenever you do something Euclidean, as you do at finite temperature and in other places, it's very simple. It's also true if you have more than three dimensions, you get more pluses, and so you don't have to write those low signs. And anyway, that's the convention I'm going to use. And so we want this to be invariant, and so that says that that the lambdas have to satisfy alpha mu lambda beta nu is equal to eta alpha beta. And that's the defining property of the Lorentz group. And one of the things that we like to do in quantum mechanics is if we have a unitary transformation, we like to write it as e to the I, some Hermitian thing. Because that Hermitian thing is a observable. But you can only do that if something is connected to the identity. So one of the things you first ask when you have a group is it all connected to the identity? And in this case, it's not. This defines the Lorentz group, the improper Lorentz group, or the full Lorentz group. And the proper Lorentz group is a subset which can be exponentiated. So we'll take the identity to be just delta alpha mu. And you can kind of see that there can't be, it can't be connected, because this equation says that the determinant of lambda squared is 1. So any matrix that has determinant minus 1, the determinant is always 1 or minus 1, but that means if I give you a matrix with, the unit matrix has determinant 1, if I give you a matrix with determinant minus 1, you can't continuously get to 1, without leaving minus 1. And so that means that anybody with the negative determinant is in a part of the group that's not connected to the identity. But it's also true that if I take alpha beta equals 0 in this equation, so I take eta 0, 0, which is minus 1 here, that's equal to, lambda 0 mu, lambda 0 nu, eta mu nu. And so that's, minus lambda 0, 0 squared plus delta ij lambda 0 I lambda, or it's lambda 0 I squared, sum over I. So that says that if I put this on the other side and this on the other side, that says that lambda 0, 0 squared is 1 plus positive. So again, the unit matrix has lambda 0, 0 is 1. So this thing is either going to be bigger than 1 or less than minus 1, but there's nothing in between. So if I give you any example where lambda 0, 0 is negative, it's also something which can't be connected to the identity, even if the determinant is 1. And that exhausts the disconnected pieces of it. So a generic Lorentz transformation can be written as a one that's continuously connected to the identity up to two transformations. And the two transformations are the ones that take you to these two categories. And so those are traditionally called time reversal and parity. And so the basic ones, parity is just 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1. And time reversal is just the matrix minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And so they both have determinant minus 1. P times T would be a determinant plus 1, but with time 0, 0 part negative. And so our job when we're representing this group on states will be take all the ones that are continuously related to the identity, act on the states, but then we'll have to go back and do these two. But if I tell you how these two act on states, then those together with the continuous ones tell you everything. So then you know everything there is to know. Good? Okay, so what I'll do is I'll erase this. All right, and so for the ones that are connected to the identity, what we'll do is we, you know, we write the infinitesimal thing as being delta mu nu plus some small omega mu nu, and then this condition says that eta mu nu lambda alpha mu lambda beta nu equals. I just expand that out, take the things linear in omega, that implies that omega lowered is antisymmetric, where I take this index and I lower it with eta mu nu. So omega mu nu is eta nu alpha omega mu alpha. I'm kind of always writing this, so this is the row and this is the column, so matrix multiplication is obvious when you do these things. And so now what we want to do is we want to build the unitary transformations. So the first thing we're going to ask is, in quantum mechanics, we want to have a bunch of matrices U. We want to have a separate one for each different Lorentz transformation and translation. And so what we want to do is we want to ask that these U's will be operators in the Hilbert space, which will have the property that if I take U if I take a matrix lambda and a vector A, which labels an element of the Poincaré group, I want to have the property that these things are going to be equal to U of lambda 3 A3, where these are the ones that I would have gotten by just iterating this thing twice. And so rather than doing that by hand, let me just state it. So lambda 3 is going to be, I use different notation, that's always a mistake. That's 2. That's lambda 2, lambda 1. And then A3 is lambda 2, A1 plus A2. So what we want, we want these U's to represent the group. So if we do a transformation and we do another transformation, we want the new result to be the thing I would have gotten by composing the two symmetry elements themselves. And so if I do this transformation twice, I get another Poincaré transformation because it's a group, and the parameters for that new transformation are related to the old ones by this, where I'm doing matrix multiplication here. And here, this is again, matrix times vector. And we want these U's to have this property that these guys are given by this. And so that's a series of relationships that relate. This has to be an identity for all A1, A2, lambda 1, and lambda 2. And then everything I'm going to say now is extracting the information that comes from that. So the first thing you do is you focus on the ones that are connected to the identity so you can exponentiate them. And so I can think of, I'll write U, I take write U of I'll take lambda to be, I'll take lambda to be this, so U of 1 plus omega, A. So that'll be, we're going to take the representation of the trivial transformation to be the unit matrix, or the unit operator, and then the things that are linear in these parameters will be, I'm just telling you the conventions we're going to use. A mu, P mu. Plus nonlinear. That defines our generators of Lorentz transformations, of which there are 6 because this has got 4 indices. They're antisymmetric because of this. And this, and of course, you get 4 generators of translations, and so altogether there's 10 generators. And so the group transformation rule is telling us how what happens if we this rule is most conveniently expressed in terms of these J's and P's, and often that's done through the commutation relations, but I would rather not do that. I want to go right to I want to do an intermediate step where we ask what happens under a finite transformation. So what we want to do is so here's where I have to apologize, because as I'm using these notes and it's on a computer, not on a piece of paper, I have to find the page. I'm kind of trying to avoid doing long things of algebra, which are going to give you tell you something you know already, that you already believe here. Here we are. Right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this, and I'm going to slap a U and a U inverse on both sides. And the convention I want to use is I'm going to multiply this by U of lambda A. Or I don't want to use A again. Call that one epsilon. I'm going to put a U inverse of lambda A. So this is the board work from hell. Let me just start again. So we had that that U of lambda of 1 plus omega epsilon that was equal to 1 plus I over 2 omega mu nu J mu nu. So now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to write U of lambda A, U inverse of lambda A, and just multiply through. And then what I did, what we'll do is we'll compare both sides to the same order in omega. But I'll first use the group multiplication rule, this, to rewrite this side. And this will lead us to the following statement. So U of lambda A, J mu nu, U inverse of lambda A, that's equal to lambda alpha mu, lambda beta nu, J alpha beta, minus P alpha A beta minus P beta. And the same thing for P. And then if you do the infinitesimal version of this again, if we make this lambda 1 plus something small, and I repeat the exercise of comparing both sides, because what we'll do is we'll say that lambda is also 1, you know, delta alpha beta plus omega alpha beta, then read off the coefficient of omega, then we get the I thought the room was going down all of a sudden. We'll get the famous commutation relation, which I might as well write once. This is going to be the more useful one, but I'll, if we specialize to infinitesimal lambda, then what we'll get is that the commutator of J mu nu J lambda rho will be minus I J mu lambda eta nu rho plus or minus the various permutations that you need, because this thing's antisymmetric under changing the pair, and these are separately antisymmetric. And there's a similar statement for J with P lambda. That's I eta mu nu P lambda minus I eta mu lambda P nu. Good. So the reason we're going to care about this is several things. One of them I'm going to come back to later on, but I'll just say it in passing here because it's one of those things that this is the natural time to say it, but it's not going to be useful till down the road. I said at the very beginning that in quantum mechanics you use unitary transformations or anti-unitary transformations. An anti-unitary transformation is one for which, you know, anti-linear transformation is a linear transformation satisfies that, you know, that I have two vectors, and I have, you know, this is L. And an anti-linear transformation is one for which these guys get complex conjugated when they come out. And people always say when you're doing symmetries that, so unitary and anti-unitary are this plus U star U is U dagger U is one. And so you might ask, what's with this whole anti-unitary thing? You know, so it's an option. You know, you only hear about it for time reversal. You know, why is that? And you can kind of see already why that's going to be. I'll come back to this again in more detail later on. But once you know this, you know everything, because what really gets derived from this is this with an I here. Because that's the thing that's appearing when I write U. It's U to the I, P dot something, because that's what the definition was here. That I is going along for the ride. And the this thing is telling you several things. It's saying that when you do a Lorentz transformation, you know, the energy is the mu equals zero component, right? We know that P mu as a four vector is the Hamiltonian, and then the three momentum is the space part. So P upper zero is the Hamiltonian, and this is showing you that the Hamiltonian is not invariant under Lorentz transformations, which you kind of knew, right? You knew that if you change frames, the energy changes. So one question will be, what's it mean to be a symmetry in quantum mechanics? Because normally you would have said, this is a symmetry if it commutes with a Hamiltonian. These don't. And so the first thing you get from this is that you have to broaden your mind as to what you mean by symmetry. And what people normally would mean, people mean different things when they're for different applications. But the old school generalization of the notion of symmetry is that what will is that basically that we're going to ask these U's to commute with the S matrix. And that says that if I have some initial state, you know, alpha in, and that's some symmetry transformation of some other state in some early time, I evolve it forward in time, and then I get some final states with these labels, alpha and beta. And what I want to ask is that in these final states, the guy that I evolve this one forward to and the guy I want evolve this one forward to, they're related by the same transformation. So I want alpha out to be given by U of beta out. This is a much weaker condition than having the symmetry commute with Hamiltonian. Because if it commutes with the Hamiltonian, then this is kind of obvious, because the Hamiltonian, you know, in and out differ by evolving in time, and it explicitly commutes, and so what's the big deal? But in what's gonna we're going to use this criterion, that the punchline of Lorentz invariance, that the implications of Lorentz invariance are going to come from this when we get pushed to find them. That's the first thing that comes out of this. But that was kind of a little bit obvious, because you knew you weren't expecting the Hamiltonian to be invariant under Lorentz transformation because it's an energy. But the other thing is this unitary anti-unitary thing. One of the basic motherhood principles I forgot to mention was stability. You want to have a vacuum. You know, you want to have the energy to be bounded from below, because if not, quantum mechanics will always take you down to wherever you can go. And so we'd like H in a reasonable theory to be bounded from below. Bounded. But when we specialize this transformation to time reversal, so I'll take A is equal to zero, and for lambda, I'll take this particular lambda, then that sign is going to make, when it multiplies here, it's going to change the sign. So what time reversal wants to do, if I call curly T, if I call that U of time reversal zero in that equation, it says that curly T times I by specialized to the Hamiltonian. So I take mu equals zero here, curly T inverse, that's equal to minus I Hamiltonian. And so this would be, because of that sign, this would be inconsistent with the Hamiltonian being bounded from below if T was unitary. Because then if T is unitary, I can cross out the I's and I directly see that H is changing sign. But because I have the option of having T be anti-unitary, I have to exercise that option if I want H to be bounded from below. And so it's because this transformation specialized to the Hamiltonian has this sign is what's telling you that T specifically has to be anti-unitary, and whereas everybody else is going to be unitary. So this is the only symmetry we're looking at that has this property, and so that's why you only really see anti-unitary transformations being used for time reversal. And what that means in principle, in practice, is that in theories, if you had a theory where parity is a symmetry, the matrix that represents parity is going to be actually a conserved thing. It's going to be something which commutes to the Hamiltonian, its remission, and so that's why you have parity quantum numbers. You might have thought if I have a time reversal invariant theory, I should have had a time reversal quantum number, and the reason you don't is because it's anti-unitary. So that a state is not described by a vector in a Hilbert space, it's described by a ray in the Hilbert space. And so if you start changing all the phases, or changing all the complex things in a ray, you can't represent it as a physical thing. So this is kind of one of those important bookmarks, which is kind of, once you see it, it's obvious, but it's, I wanted to flag that in passing. So when we come back to time reversal, we're gonna be talking about anti-unitary transformations because this property led to this property, and we wanted H to be bounded from below.
Could you repeat that again? So, all the states realize as rays in a Hilbert space.
Yeah.
So where does the problem with the quantum number of time reversal comes in?
Well, because the thing is that if it was a physical thing, it's supposed to act on rays, not on vectors. So it should agree on. I should have a definition which is the same no matter which particular vector you chose. And this can't because it's changing all the phases. Yeah.
We ask, we require for the out states and in states to be in the same representation of one group. That's what we ask?
Yeah, we're asking that if this diagram should commute. If time is going that way, I have a state here and a state here. If the symmetry takes that to that, and I evolve them both forward in time, then they still get taken to each other. Which is would certainly be true if this commuted with the S matrix, but if this commuted with the Hamiltonian, but it's more generally true for the Poincaré transformation. All right. So what I want to head towards is so these are the operators we have in the Hilbert space. The story I want to tell is to do with fields, and I'm going to basically take for granted, I'm just going to start talking about fields because you've all seen field theory. But I want to emphasize a couple things along the way. And what we're going to do is ask, how do these transformations act on fields? So the basic guys in quantum field theory that you're always defining things in terms of are these A and A daggers, which satisfy these commutation relations, AI, A star J. And this is a commutator or an anti-commutator, depending if they're bosons or fermions, is equal to delta IJ. So minus here just means commutator, and plus here means the anti-commutator. But in field theory, you're always writing things in terms of some field, A of X and T. Let's just say A of X, just all space-time, which is typically given by sum over I of ui of x ai. Now, in relativistic applications, you're tempted to write plus something else here, like ui star ai star. And I'm not writing that deliberately because that's something which is that's a derived thing. If you were just doing quantum mechanics and asking how do I change the number of particles, you would do that in terms of these A's and A daggers. The only reason you start talking about these fields that are in position space is because of this property that I've hopefully not erased. Oh, I did erase it. I erased it right here. So this property that H comes to you as an integral d3x of some Hamiltonian density. This was the thing I was saying, that if I said that H was a sum over position, effectively, because I wanted U, which was e to the minus I h t, I wanted that to come as a product over positions of a bunch of U's. And that was kind of morally because I wanted to, if probabilities were factorized, I didn't want time evolution to ruin that. If factorize at spatial separation. So it's only at the point where you say that that's telling me that I should be thinking of my Hamiltonian as coming to as being local in the position, so it's an extensive variable. It's at that point that these variables are not the most convenient ones for describing what's going on, because the creation, the states that you build from the vacuum, you know, by creating particles, those are typically energy eigenstates. You're choosing them to simplify your life when you're doing a calculation, but they're not usually optimized to express locality. And so what the way you build in the locality of the Hamiltonian is you choose to build a Hamiltonian out of these fields, products of fields and their derivatives, where the fields are linear combinations of the destruction operators. And the most common case, since we're interested in translation invariant problems, we're going to be interested in a basis where we'll use momentum as the label. And so in practice, what we're going to do here is write, you know, we'll have some field A, or say A. It'll be an integral D3P. And I'm going to put in conventional factors here. Let me just start like this. So we'll have a of p e to the I p dot x, and now it depends on if we're the Schrodinger picture, the interaction picture, the Heisenberg picture, whether there's a time dependence here. But if we're in the Heisenberg picture, we would have a time dependence. And these normalizations are just being chosen so that if I demand that in momentum space a of p with a star of q is a Dirac delta function, so I use a continuum normalization, then this choice will have the property that a of x with a star of xt and a star of yt will be a delta function in position space, which is why it's convenient. So where we're going to go is there'll be a story which will lead us to the statement in relativity specifically that whenever you have a piece like this, you're going to want to also have a piece involving a star, and you're going to want that because you're going to want the Hamiltonian to commute at space-like separations, and you're going to want that because you're going to want time-ordered products to be Lorentz invariant. So in a Lorentz invariant theory, there will be an argument we're going to get to, which says that you do the thing you normally do in relativity where you add a complex conjugate. But if you're only worried about locality, this is all you'd have to do. And this is already where there's choices that you can make about what fields you can use to represent what kinds of particles. And so what I'm heading towards that argument now. I'd like to say, if you, in general, you could imagine, I've written this as if it's a scalar field, that it has no indices. But the particle could have, had some sort of a spin, so I could label it with its angular momentum, as well as its momentum. And the field could have been, I could imagine writing a vector field here, say, or some other field. I could just have some indices. And so in general, I could have had here some coefficient a n of p and sigma times a of p and sigma. And what I'd like to do is to pin down what that has to be in order for the transformation properties of this and this under Lorentz transformations, the Poincaré transformations, to be consistent. And that's what leads you to the statement about which fields represent which particles. And in particular, that'll be the thing that tells us we cannot represent a massless spin 1 particle with a 4 vector. And the logic of the argument is, it's a Clebsch-Gordan argument, that if I have something transforming in one way under a group, something transforming differently under that group, then these guys you can figure out just using the same logic you use for Clebsch-Gordan coefficients for rotations. And you know that these things have to transform differently because the one thing you have to ask this guy to do is to transform in a unitary way, and we've built them, right? These are the guys, if we had these operators, these are the guys that are taking states to states, and because the states are created by these A's, you know, if I know that P sigma is given by some unitary transformation of A sigma prime, then because these guys, you know, P sigma is what I get by acting on the no particle state with a creation operator, and then assuming that the no particle state is itself Lorentz invariant, so we'll assume that that U of lambda and A of 0 is equal to 0. You know, this transformation rule says how these A's transform, because it's basically saying that these A's transform the same, the A star is transformed the way the particle states transform. So the goal I have now is to write down explicitly what the transformation rules are for particle states, and they will be by construction unitary, because we're designing it in a quantum mechanics where, you know, we've made these things unitary or anti-unitary. Whereas these guys are going to transform in a finite dimensional way, because we're always going to have a finite number of them. And so we're going to be looking for the finite dimensional representations of the Poincaré group, Lorentz group in particular. And it's a theorem that the finite dimensional ones are not unitary, and the unitary ones are infinite dimensional. So they can't be the same representation. And that's why you need these guys. And so, but then by pinning down exactly how they transform, we get to pin down exactly what these things are. And the point is that they're determined up to normalization. So there's a conventional normalization you get to choose. I'm going to choose it this way, so these things will be normalized in some very simple way. But everything else, the P and sigma dependence is given to you, and the N dependence. That's where we're going. Good. So we have to talk about the representations now. So the goal is, I want to tell you what I want you to know about the finite dimensional representations, which would be how the fields transform, and what we know about the particle representations. So let's start here. Let's start with the simpler one is the finite dimensional representation. So finite dimensional. Some level we're representing the translations with x and t. So the bang for your buck is going to be the UN dependence is to do with the Lorentz transformation. So we want finite dimensional representations represent of Lorentz group. So what are we looking for? You know, the bottom line is states are transforming in the way I've erased probably by now. Actually, probably it's on the board below here. States are transforming like this. So operators are transforming. If I had if I had some operator acting on alpha, then that's the operator acting on U of beta. So if I write this as being, what do I want to say? So if I take this data and I evolve it, then I take U on both sides. And I've done that wrong. Let me write a U inverse here. Right. So this is saying that I'm doing this backwards, but this is showing you that if the states are mapping to one another through the U's, then what will happen is that all the operators will transform under a similarity transformation in such a way that all the matrix elements of the operators are unchanged. So what we're asking for more precisely here is we want to know if I take U, and there's a convention about U or U inverse, which I want to make sure I get right. So I want U of lambda A, or U of lambda 0, which I'll just call it, let's just call that U of lambda. I want U of lambda times AM. If I take some operator U inverse of lambda. For this to be in a linear representation means that this should be a linear combination of these A's again. I'm looking for some matrix, D, M, N. And it depends on lambda, but I'm going to write it as a lambda inverse. Let's not focus on the position dependence right now. Let's just focus on the vectorness right now. I'm looking for some matrix of coefficients which will have the property that these u's satisfy this group property that u of lambda 1, u of lambda 2 is equal to u of lambda 1, lambda 2. So these d's are going to inherit that, and this lambda inverse is there so that the d's do it in a kind of a more standard way. So if I take u of lambda 1, u of lambda 2, if I just slap the u inverse twice around a, 2, that'll be, and I'm doing a sum over n here. I'm using always the Einstein summation convention that if I repeat an index, it's summed. We'll have a dmp of, the first thing that will happen is I'll do the first transformation, so I'll get this. I'll get dpn lambda 1, guy on the inside was 2 inverse. AP, N, sorry. And then I slap the second UU inverse and it hits this guy. And so it's going to give me, I'll get a D, N, M, and lambda 1 inverse, A, M. There's too many. Did that wrong. I didn't do my rule faithfully. Let's do this in steps. Let's say lambda 1, lambda 1, lambda 1. So now I take u of lambda 2, u of lambda 1, am, u inverse of lambda 1, lambda 2. So that's dmn of lambda 1 inverse, u of lambda 2, an, u inverse of lambda 2. And so this is again now d. N P of lambda 2 inverse AP. And I have so this is the matrix product, right, of D of lambda 1 inverse, d of lambda 2 inverse, ap, m, p, p. And I think I've screwed up on it. I had one job and I got it wrong, I think. Is one of those things where I have to change the. No, I didn't do it wrong. So what have I done? I'm confusing myself in a way that I shouldn't be doing here. Ah, that's what it is, yeah. Right, so what we're going to ask is, this is, I haven't lied to you yet. So what we want is we want these matrices to satisfy that D of lambda 1, D of lambda 2 is equal to D of lambda 1, lambda 2 as matrices.
Isn't that like the opposite? If we look at this equation here, you have like lambda 1, A1, lambda 2, A2, and then lambda 3, A3.
Oh, I wrote it wrong. Yeah, that's right. It should have been 1, 2.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. This formula is the formula is correct, but I just labeled it wrong. Because what you're supposed to do is you first perversely I'm doing the first one I'm calling it two and the second one I'm calling it one, which is that's the problem. But if you act on a vector with this and then you then act on the vector with that, you're going to get that. So the order it's just my labeling is wrong there. So this is kind of what you traditionally ask matrices to do if they're representing a group, and the reason these inverses are here. Is that when you do the slapping of the operators around the fields, you can see that the first one we did was lambda 1, and then we did lambda 2. And so we got lambda 2, but we got lambda 2 in the right here rather than lambda 2 in the left because, you know, 1 came first. So this is what I would have had if I did lambda 2 first and then I did lambda 1 because I'm acting first with lambda 2, then with lambda 1. And so because this is coming to you with the matrices in the opposite order, so here I did lambda 1 first and then I did lambda 2 later, but I'm multiplying by lambda 2 first on A and then multiplying by lambda inverse or D the D for lambda 1 next. The way I can have these matrices, this be consistent with this is that I use the representation of the inverse matrix here because the inverse changes the order, right? So if I take lambda 1, lambda 2 inverse, that's lambda 2 inverse, lambda 1 inverse. And so this is consistent with this. Is consistent with this because of the use of the inverse here. It's just a convention. You could have chosen your rule here to be that they come in the opposite order, but I didn't. All right. Yeah. So that says we're out of time, just about. So let me just. Maybe this is as good a place as any to pick it up next time. I was hoping to get farther than this, but we did some procedural things, and you can give me some feedback as to how the speed is. So where we're going to go next is that there's a standard way of writing these finite dimensional representations, and what we're going to do is we're going to take the commutation relations, and you make the observation that these look like SU2 cross SU2 if you label them right. And so if you know how to represent if you know how to find matrices that do that for SU2, which you do, because that's what spin is in quantum mechanics, then you can just lift that for free and build representations of these Ds. And they're going to be, so they'll be representations of spin are being labeled by a total spin. And then there's an index for the various vectors in the representation, which is the third component of spin. And so we will have those labels for Lorentz group, but we're going to have pairs of them because there's two SU2s corresponding to the Lorentz group. One of them corresponds to rotations, and one of them corresponds to boosts, or various combinations of those two things. And so that AB representation, these are the two spins. So the way I choose representations will be, if I can think of the Lorentz group as the product of two SU2s, then I can label the representations by the labels of SU2 representations, which would have been, you know, J, the total spin, and sigma, the eigenstate of the third component of angular momentum. So that means that these matrices will be labeled by two spins, one for each SU2, which is what A and B are. So these are 0, 1/2, 1. That's what these have to be. And then there'll be another little label, little a and little b, which ranges from minus a plus 1, and so on, you know, to a minus 1 to a. And so we'll get matrices that are 2a plus 1, by 2a plus 1 times matrices that are 2b plus 1 times 2b plus 1 in size. And so I'll do that next time, this afternoon. So see you at 2:30.